on Bundy, Senate District 8.
Thank you.
And Bennett Davis, Chair, yes. District K.
Johnny Ellis, Senate District L, Downtown and Midtown Anchorage.
John Cowdery.
We also have online from the Kodiak LIO, Senator Gary Stevens. Gary, welcome.
Thank you, Senator Ellis.
Are there any other legislators online? I saw Representative Carl Gatto here in the audience. You're welcome to join us. Please come forward. We're going to introduce Senator French here in a moment, but Carl, come on up and join us. You're very welcome. If there are any other legislators online, please make your presence known. Oh, Representative Lindsey Holmes, welcome. Come on up, join us, please. We need you up here to fill some of these empty chairs. There's a high level of interest in the subject, but a lot of busy schedules by legislators. We expect other folks to join us as we proceed. And I do want to note that there's several of our members who have meetings around 2:30 or 3 o'clock this afternoon, so some folks will be in and out of the meeting. The purpose of the meeting today is to discuss the issue of healthcare reform to get a jump start on the 90-day session coming up. The bill before us, before our two committees, is Senate Bill 160, universal healthcare coverage for all Alaskans. As we begin, I want to thank the legislators for your time and interest today and thank the staff for pulling this meeting together. It's an excellent agenda. I hope you've all been able to see, and we'll introduce them as they come forward, the experts who have joined us from here in Alaska and from the lower 48. It's really quite a lineup of folks to share information with the Alaska legislature on a very important subject to our constituents. But first, we'll begin with an overview of Senate Bill 160 by Senator Hollis French, the prime sponsor of the bill. Senator French, if you join us, thank you for your sponsorship and your leadership on the issue, and if you could take us through an overview of the bill, we'd appreciate it.
Indeed, Chair Davis, Chair Ellis, thank you for making your committees available for today's hearing. Let me also thank the members who are here and online. I'd just like to take a moment and acknowledge both Chair Davis and Chair Ellis for your years of leadership in the area of healthcare, and thank you for that. There has been an enormous amount of staff work that's gone into today's hearing. I'd like to personally thank Dana Owen, Richard Benavides, and Andy Motoro for their excellent efforts. You do have an impressive array of individuals lined up to testify today. I'm particularly grateful for the presence of Mr. Edmund Hazelmeyer from the Heritage Foundation and Mr. Michael Tanner of the Cato Institute. They are both nationally recognized experts in health policy. They each travel a long way to be here today. I appreciate that and look forward to hearing their thoughts on SB 160. So I'm going to be brief so the committee can get the benefit of the many perspectives that are in the room here today. I'm going to speak for just a few minutes on three topics. The first is an overview of the problem. The second is an overview of the bill. And the third will give you a look at a website that we have created to help guide Alaskans through this complex topic. So first, an overview of the problem. There are 100,000 Alaskans that do not have health insurance. That's about 15% of the state's population. Keep in mind that 60,000 of those individuals, 60,000 of that 100,000, have jobs. They simply work for employers that either cannot afford to provide or choose to not provide health insurance as a result of the jobs that those individuals have. The uninsured population gets medical care, of course. They simply pay out of pocket for what they can afford, and what they can't afford gets passed on to someone who can't pay. Those who do have insurance are one group that helps pay for those who do not. If you have an insurance policy here in Alaska, you pay about 14% more than you should because of the cost of uncompensated care delivered to the rest of the state. For a family of four, that's about $1,000 a year in premiums above and beyond what you should have to pay. In essence, it's a tax on those who do have insurance, shifting money to those who do not. The state of Alaska pays about $19 million more every year than it should for medical care for its employees because of the increased costs of medical coverage or medical care because it's inflated for those who can pay. Finally, on this point, many of you were present this year in Juneau when Mark Foster from the Institute of Social and Economic Research spoke to us about the disadvantages that we experience as a state because of the high cost of medical care here. When you compete against other states and other nations for business, you are at a disadvantage because we pay more for health care here than we should part of that overspending is due to a lack of insurance for part of the population. So let me now give you just a brief overview of the bill.
Senator French, before you go forward, I'd like to acknowledge the presence of Representative Mike Dugan. Representative Dugan, you're welcome to join us up front if you care to.
Okay.
Senator?
Thank you. The bill sponsors, yourself, Senator Ellis, Senator Wilikowski, and myself, we modeled this bill roughly on the Massachusetts plan that was created and passed about a year ago. You'll be hearing more about the Massachusetts experience as we go through the day, particularly from Mr. Hazelmeyer and Mr. Tanner. I won't go into great detail there, but to point out that it was a great collaboration, if you will, between a Republican governor, Mr. Romney, and the very Democratic Massachusetts legislature, who came together really to produce something kind of unique in the annals of American health reform. Let me begin by telling you what the bill is not. It is not socialized medicine, which usually means health care delivered by the government. And it's not single payer, which usually is a feature of most government-run health systems and essentially turns all insurance functions over to one entity, usually a governmental entity. Instead, the bill really represents a way forward in the health reform arena that embraces the American values of competition and individual responsibility. Essentially, the bill requires each person, each Alaskan, that does not have insurance to go out and get a policy, and then it uses a combination of market reforms and subsidies to make that policy affordable. If you are currently covered by an insurance policy, this bill does not affect you, except in as much as you should experience a decrease in the price of your premium should the bill be passed and successfully implemented. There are three key features to the bill. The first is the creation of an Alaska Health Care Board. I've got a poster over there that gives you something of a visual overview of the bill. If you're more of a visual learner, it helps you kind of see how the pieces go together. You'll see the Health Care Board in the towards the top on that top row of boxes. The Health Care Board, the bill in its current form, calls for the creation of this board by the appointment of 11 members by the governor, subject to confirmation by the legislature. And the board has two functions. The first is to define essential health services, to lay out what it means when it says to be covered by a health insurance policy, to define those essential services. And second, to certify the private insurance plans that meet the basic criteria the board has set out. That's why you see the boxes. As they go to the right, the board will essentially state what it means to be covered by an insurance policy, to define what those health care services are. And then having done so, they survey the marketplace, if you will, and then put their stamp of approval on each insurance policy that meets their basic criteria. The second key feature is the health care fund. The health care fund will be made up of state, federal, and employer contributions. The fund will issue vouchers to qualified individuals in order to assist the individual in purchasing a health insurance policy. The final key feature is what we call the health care clearinghouse, which is on the right there in the pink box, is the health care clearinghouse. And that's where individuals will take their vouchers to go and select an insurance policy. It is essentially a marketplace. Mr. Hazelmeyer, in his writings, compares it to something like a stock exchange, a place to match buyers of insurance with sellers of policies in an efficient way. That, in essence, is a brief overview of the bill. You can see on the left-hand side, it splits up the uninsured Alaska population into three categories, if you will. Those whose incomes fall below 100% of the federal poverty line, those whose incomes fall between 100% and 300% of the federal poverty line, and those who fall above. If you are below 100% of the federal poverty line and you are not covered by Medicaid, you would, in essence, qualify for a voucher from the health care fund that would allow you to go to the clearinghouse and purchase the health insurance policy. If you are between 100% and 300% of the federal poverty line, you'd be on a sliding scale, where the fund would issue a voucher for part of the amount of a insurance policy, and you would have to come out of pocket for the rest. Finally, if you're over 300% of the federal poverty line, you're essentially on your own to go buy a policy, although you may be the recipient of a so-called specified beneficiary fund. You can see that on the grayscale box in the middle. Those are funds deposited by your employer if the employer doesn't provide health insurance. But many employers, and you'll hear from one today, desperately want to give health care coverage to their employees. They simply can't afford it. And should they choose to make a contribution to a specified beneficiary fund, you could take that amount of money along with some of your own money and go and buy yourself a policy. That's essentially how the bill works. Let me my last point is to give you a quick look at the website we've set up. And when I say we, I mean my staffer, Andy Motoro, has set it up. He designed it, he created it, he's got it up on the web, he did it.
That's what we.
He really does deserve extra credit for this. And you'll see that the website does many things. I just want to walk you through one very quick feature, and that is it shows the public how the bill affects them by embracing and setting out a calculator so that you can put in how much money you make per month, how many individuals are in your household, and then using the Massachusetts plan as our template, we estimate what your out-of-pocket cost would be for a policy if the bill were to be implemented the way we envision. So let's just go ahead and go to the calculator. And we're going to take as our example a family of three that does not have health insurance, where the gross monthly income is $3,000 per month. And anybody in Alaska can go to this website, type in their own personal information, and get from the website a rough answer to the cost to the question, what will this cost me if the bill is implemented? And what the website tells you is that if you go down a little bit further, at the very bottom now of the screen, you can see that in the bold print, if you lived in Massachusetts, the monthly premium cost for each adult in your household would be about $40. So a total cost of about $120 for a family of three to purchase a voucher for a health insurance policy, which I think something of interest to most folks who are comparing this to their other monthly bills, and they realize that it's actually within reach. It's not free, you have to pay something for it, but it puts it within a realistic cost so that Alaskans can be covered with a health insurance policy, much like the rest of us. Those are my opening remarks and a brief overview of the website. If I may, Chairman Ellis, I'll decline to answer questions because we have so many interested individuals behind us, but I don't mean to stop. I'm worried about the amount of time you have for the afternoon.
Let's get the lights back on. We are going to take just a moment for a couple of quick comments and questions.
Thank you, sir.
But we will get on to the experts rather quickly. First, let me note that in addition to Senator Gary Stevens in Kodiak, we also have Representative Wilson and Senator Elton online. So welcome to those folks as well. Senator Mundy, a quick question or comment?
Two real quick ones, I hope. The health care board, would they be state employees or would they be like the Board of Regents and just basically be reimbursed for expenses? And two, as they define essential services, we're going to end up like Oregon and saying, well, if you fall off the bottom, sorry, if you got a rare disease, you just don't get covered. And three, will there be credit for healthy lifestyle?
In order, Senator Bundy, through the chair, A, more like the Board of Regents. B, we don't imagine rationing. That's the beauty of not going to so-called socialized medicine or single payer, is that you avoid the rationing problem that the other states have encountered as they move towards the more socialized or left side of the spectrum on health care. So I think the short answer is no, although I imagine the experts will have a little bit more of a nuanced view of that question. And finally, your third question was
healthy lifestyle.
Absolutely, yes.
Non-smokers get
absolutely, yes. Yes, there should, and moreover, there's for young people, 18 to 26, Massachusetts has a feature that recognizes the fact that they are an especially impervious or healthy group, and they tend to pay less than others as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Mundy. Senator Cowdery?
Thank you. In your opinion, I know you're in the legal world, what's the cause of the increase of care? Is it the drugs? I know I've taken some medication for 20 some years and it's probably increased its cost 10 times in that same pill. Also, what do you think? Is it the doctor's cost, the hospital, the drug cost? What attributes to the increase in our medical.
Senator Cowdery, through the chair, I wish I could give you a short answer. I just was this afternoon studying a recent ICER report on the high cost of medical care in the state of Alaska, and they couldn't pin it down. So far be it from me to come in here and give you a 20-second answer on what it is. I'll tell you what it's not, and that is there's a certain myth, I think, sort of an urban myth, that it's lawyers and insurance and lawsuits and so forth. And there is pretty good data on that. And the current estimate is that the cost of all the litigation over medical malpractice amounts to about 1% of the total national spending on healthcare. So it's probably not that. I think you're onto something. I think it's the high cost of drugs and the high cost of medical care. We do enjoy some of the best medical care in the world, and we pay for it.
It's a great question. We'll ask some of the national experts to share with us their thoughts about cost drivers at the national level and state specific as well. It's the question all legislators ask. So any other quick comments or questions for Senator French? If not, thank you very much for your presentation. We're going to move now to Mr. Michael Tanner, Director of Health and Welfare Studies at the Cato Institute, one of our national experts. Tanner's research has focused largely on market-based approaches to addressing healthcare issues, focusing on individual responsibility over government control. We're very pleased to have you with us. Thanks for making the trip north, and please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, and I really appreciate the opportunity to come up and first see your incredibly beautiful state. My first trip here, and I have to say it's been wondrous, so that's worth the price of a ticket by itself.
Welcome. Spread the word.
Absolutely. I plan to. You have a copy of my written testimony, I believe, so I will try to keep my formal remarks short and maybe answer some questions, which I think is probably a more useful way to do this. Let me say at the beginning that I think it's very important that in considering any health care reform, we recognize that the United States provides the finest health care in the world. If you want to measure outcomes of almost any disease, you will find that people are better off in the United States being treated than almost anywhere else in the world. The most recent statistics on cancer, for example, the five-year survivability rate for almost every type of cancer is higher in the United States than in any other country in the world. And to a large extent, the reason we have such high-quality health care is that we have a free market health care system. And we should be very careful as we go forward and reform it and deal with the very real problems that we're facing, problems of cost, problems of the number of uninsured, problems of uneven quality, that we do not damage that high-quality system. In many ways, we should be guided by the Hippocratic Oath, first, do no harm. And in that, we should be very, very careful of any reform that we make. With that said, I do want to thank Senator French for the introduction of this bill and for raising some very serious issues dealing with health care reform in Alaska. And I do think this bill takes some good steps in terms of raising those issues. And in particular, I think this is a very valuable bill in the sense that it is not a single-payer system. It is not a government-run health care system. The simple fact is that if you look around the world, every government-run health care system in the world rations care, denies care to individuals, and that actually has a cost in terms of human lives. As your next door, your neighbor in Canada, the Canadian Supreme Court, in 2005, struck down a portion of their national health care system. And in doing so, Beverly McLaughlin, who was the Chief Justice of that Supreme Court, said it was uncontroverted by the Canadian government that many of the people on the waiting list in Canada, and there are about 800,000 currently on the waiting list, that many of those people were living in chronic pain and that many would die while on the waiting list for care. That is not the type of system you want to bring to Alaska or, for that matter, to the United States. That said, I do, however, have some serious questions about the direction of SB 160. First, I have very serious questions about the employer mandate involved here. It's a simple matter of economics, in fact, that employers are indifferent to the type of compensation they provide their workers. It doesn't matter whether they're providing those workers wages or health insurance or retirement benefits or paying taxes on those workers. It is all the same compensation as far as the employer is concerned. He's paying a certain sum per worker, and it doesn't really matter how that sum is divided up. And in fact, if you raise the cost of the worker in any way without increasing the amount of productivity from that worker, the employer is simply going to have to find other ways to reduce the cost, and they can do this by cutting back on other benefits, not paying as much into the retirement program, for example, or lowering wages, or they can do it by reducing the number of employees they have, by not hiring as many in the future or laying off current workers. They can reduce the wages, the raises they would have given in the future. But in some way, that cost will ultimately be borne by the employee, that any cost you put on the backs of employers will ultimately be paid by the workers themselves, not by the employer. The employer is simply a collection point for the cost that you add on, not the actual person who will bear that cost. Second, I have serious concerns about the individual mandate. I do find that an individual mandate requiring that everyone purchase health insurance is a serious intrusion on individual liberty and decision making. Prior to Massachusetts implementing this last year, no state had ever required its citizens, simply by virtue of being a citizen of the state and for no other reason, to purchase a specific government-designed product. Now, I understand many people liken this to a car insurance mandate. You know, if you drive a car, you have to buy auto insurance. I would just point out that if you don't own a car, you don't have to have auto insurance. It is not a mandate that applies to you simply by virtue of living in the state. It is a mandate that applies when you apply for a certain privilege, which is driving, which we have long recognized as a privilege and not a right, versus which is very different than living in the state. However, I think auto insurance does provide a pretty good analogy when you look at the implementation and whether an individual mandate is going to be effective. The simple fact is that 47 states, including Alaska, have an individual mandate for auto insurance. In virtually every one of those states, the number of people driving without auto insurance is almost as high as the number of people who don't have health insurance. In fact, on a national average, it is higher. If both states, and I believe Alaska is one of them, actually require you to get uninsured motorist auto insurance, so that you can be protected against all the people out there driving around without auto insurance. The individual mandate is not very effective, and it's relatively easy to enforce. You know who is driving a car. You can't register a car in Alaska without auto insurance. It's relatively easy to enforce. And a health insurance mandate is much more difficult. What mechanism are you going to use in order to track down every mentally ill person, every homeless person, every undocumented worker, every person who moves in and out of the state as a seasonal worker? You're going to track them all down, find out whether they have the proper type of health and insurance, and then somehow penalize them if they don't comply with the mandate. I find it highly unlikely that you're going to succeed in this. In fact, in Massachusetts, they've sort of recognized this. They've already exempted 20% of the uninsured population from having to comply with the mandate. And if you look at the rate of take-up, the number of people who are buying insurance in response to the mandate, you find out that they're current, unless there's a huge uptake in the next few months, they're not going to get all the people who are required to participate. They are far below the compliance rate that's required here. And Massachusetts actually has an advantage in that they have their state income tax, which they can use to both find out whether you're paying insurance and to penalize you if you fail to take it up. That's a luxury, or actually an advantage, I guess, that Alaska doesn't have in that sense. So again, I question how this mandate is going to be enforced. Finally, I'm very concerned about the individual mandate because I believe it's the first in a set of dominoes, that if you have such a mandate, it inevitably requires this whole series of additional regulations which leads down the road to ever greater government control and government involvement in healthcare. The simple fact is if you're going to have a mandate that people purchase health insurance, you have to define what the health insurance is. And SB 160 does so, creating the board which can determine what are essential health services. I can almost guarantee you that as soon as you have a board that can define what insurance components, what things must be covered in insurance, that everyone in the state must buy, regardless of how much it costs, every special interest in the state will descend on you. You will find every disease constituency at the door, every provider group will be here asking for inclusion and saying that it is not essential health insurance unless their particular disease is covered or their particular provider group can offer it in care. And you will find that the cost of that insurance product will rise considerably. And once the cost rises, you're either going to have to follow that with ever-increasing levels of subsidy, or you're going to have to somehow cap premiums. If you cap premiums, you lead down the course, the road, I think, to rationing care. Third, I have a certain amount of trouble with the level of subsidies in the bill as proposed, going up to 300% of poverty, which would be for a family of four some $62,000 a year above the median income in Alaska. Essentially, you would be expanding welfare well into the middle class. Make no doubt about it, the subsidies under this program are a form of welfare, and while we may want to provide subsidies to low-income people, do we really want to extend those subsidies well into the middle class? Doing so, you create an enormous constituency for people to want ever more subsidies. First of all, people want to raise the subsidies higher. After all, if the fellow earning a couple of $1,000s less than me gets a voucher, why shouldn't I? Why should cut it off at 300% of poverty? Why not 400 or 500%? Why shouldn't I get it? You're already seeing that with the S-CHIP program, where they want proposals in Congress now to raise it to 400%. Of the poverty level, 80-some thousand dollars a year where people would qualify it, and to raise the level of what those subsidies are. The vouchers might not be 100% now, but there's now have a whole constituency which wants to go out and vote for people who would raise that level of that subsidy. Finally, with when you start moving subsidies into that level, you get a huge crowd-out effect. This is well known under Medicaid and S-CHIP. The academic studies show it's a continual such problem, that basically people who are buying health insurance today on their own or employers who are offering health insurance to low-wage workers essentially stop, since they can shift that cost onto the backs of the taxpayers by giving up the insurance that they're currently paying for and simply letting it be paid for under this program. That's a small problem when you're dealing with 100% of poverty, but when you start raising the subsidies into the 200 and 300% of the poverty level, that increases significantly. Finally, let me just raise a concern about the board. Again, as I say, creating this board, which is a huge regulatory authority, is very similar to the connector in Massachusetts. While that connector in Massachusetts has already used its regulatory power, for example, to require that all health insurance in the state offer prescription drug benefits, that's going to be phased in over several years because of the cost, but they're still going to require it. They have prohibited any insurance in the state from offering a plan with a deductible of more than $2,000. So essentially the sort of high dollar deductible insurance, which is the type of insurance people really should be buying as low cost, has been prohibited. I think you're essentially creating yet another regulatory board or body in the state which will add to the cost of insurance. Let me just close by this. I know I've gone on for longer than I intended to. I think the problem with health insurance is a very real one. And I can really applaud Senator French and the rest of you for being involved in this. Unfortunately, the bad news I can bring to you is there's a limited amount that state governments can do. The real problems with health care lie in Washington. It lies with our federal tax code and our federal antitrust laws and some other things that drive up the cost of insurance. There's a limited amount of what state governments can do, and I applaud you for trying to get around that and trying to do something. But most of what state governments can do is bad and going to make the problem worse. There are things you can do. You have far too many mandated benefits in Alaska. You should be looking at repealing them, not adding to them. You should make insurance purchases across borders legal. An Alaskan who wants to go to Idaho and go online and buy insurance in Idaho, where there's only 13 mandates and it's far cheaper than it is in this state, should be able to do so. That should be legalized. You should allow associated groups where small employers in different industries can band together in order to get the same sort of benefits that large employers do in terms of scope and insurance, in terms of a larger insurance pool. The most important thing you can do is to try to bring down the cost of insurance. If too many people don't have insurance, the number one reason is that they can't afford it. Unfortunately, too often we look at insurance and we say that only a Lexus will do, or only a Cadillac will do. Well, some people have to buy a Ford Pinto. You know, sometimes you have to go out and get an inexpensive policy and learn to walk before you can run. Unfortunately, in this state, as in too many others, the mandates and other regulations that you add on to these policies makes everyone go out and buy a Lexus. Well, the only car you could buy in Alaska was an Lexus. That's what very few people would have cars. Thank you all very much. I really appreciate you taking the time to listen to me, and I'll be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Mr. Tanner, thank you for your presentation. I'd like to note that we're joined by Representative Harry Crawford. Harry, you're welcome to join us up here at the table if you choose. And Joe Hardenbrook is online representing Senator Joe Thomas up in Fairbanks. Senator Thomas sends his regrets, and he's traveling and not able to join us. Comments or questions for Mr. Tanner? Representative Gatto.
How do we handle the situation of pre-existing illnesses? And tell me if I'm correct, it's been told to me that 90% of your lifetime health costs occur in your final year of life.
Yeah, it's a little bit less than, it's about half of your lifetime expenses will be in your last year of life. The biggest problem, of course, is that no one can predict what that last year of life is. In fact, there's actually been studies where they've asked doctors to predict whether someone was going to die in the next year, and you were better off flipping a coin. They actually had a less than a 50-50 success rate, so I wouldn't necessarily trust the doctors to make that call. It's sort of unknowable. But in answer to your larger question in terms of how do we handle pre-existing conditions, there's two answers to that. Number one is you want people to buy health insurance while they are young and healthy so that they will then have health insurance when they're old and sick. If you tell people that, in effect, that we will not penalize you for waiting till you're old and sick to buy insurance, and at the same time we make it very expensive for you to buy health insurance when you're young and healthy, people won't buy it when they're young and healthy. In many ways, it's as if you could wait until you cracked up your car and then you pick up the phone and say, hey, Geico, I'd like to buy that auto insurance right now. So we don't want to allow that to happen. Essentially, what you need to do is make it inexpensive for young, healthy people to buy insurance. That means eliminating those mandates, letting them buy that Ford Probe, that basic starter policy. They stay insured. They have health insurance later on when they get sick, when they get older. The second is for people who are sort of caught in between. It's a relatively small number that are actually medically uninsurable. And for those people, the best thing you can do is sort of take them out of the insurance pool, create a high-risk pool like people do with auto insurance, and subsidize those people. Essentially, don't bend the entire health insurance pool around them or the entire regulatory system around them. They're a fairly small number. Take them out of the pool altogether and subsidize them separately.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you. Thank you for your comments. The comment about the doctors not knowing how long we're going to live reminds me of the old native fellow here in Alaska who said he wished he knew the place that was he was going to die, he would never go there. would that we could. Your comments and answer to Representative Gatto sounds as if you're endorsing some kind of a health savings plan where you're basically building an annuity aimed at your health needs later in life. Is that what I'm hearing?
That's part of it. Essentially, what I'm saying is you have to recognize what insurance is supposed to be. Insurance is supposed to spread catastrophic risk. It is the idea that if you take insurance on your house, it's very unlikely that your house is going to burn down. But if it does burn down, it's very few people have enough money in their pocket to be able to go out and rebuild. So what you do is you spread that risk among everybody, all of whom have a very low likelihood of their house burning down, but high costs if it does, and you buy fire insurance. That's what it's about. Health insurance today, we actually sort of turn around. It really won't give you any money if your house burns down, but we expect it to routinely pay for patching up the all the front lawn maintenance and painting the house and painting the trim and all of that. It sort of pays routinely low dollar routine costs. We need to turn that around so that we have sort of catastrophic insurance at the top end of the scale and that those routine low dollar costs are being paid for people out of their pocket, making them much better consumers of health care. The reason we don't do that is primarily because of the tax law, and this is what I was referring to in terms of the federal tax code, that in essence rewards you for employer-provided health insurance, subsidizes that through the tax code, and rewards you for getting first-dollar insurance coverage and penalizes you if you pay for health insurance out of your pocket because you have to do that with after-tax dollars. Health savings accounts are one way to try to equalize that tax burden. There's a number of other proposals at the federal level to do that. But one way to do that is in terms of using some sort of way in which you can get the same tax break paying for money out of pocket that you would get for getting an employer-subsidized tax-subsidized first-dollar insurance policy.
Thank you. Other comments or questions? If not, Mr. Tanner, thank you very much for your time and your travel north. If you could stick around with us, there may be some other discussion later on that you could contribute to.
Absolutely.
We appreciate it. Our next presenter is another national expert, Mr. Edmund F. Hazelmayer, Senior Research Fellow, Center for Health Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation. You're a nationally recognized expert on healthcare policy with over 20 years of research experience, and we're lucky to have you here. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Senator, and thank you for the invitation to be up here, and it's nice to be back in Anchorage. I've actually been here before and enjoyed my time. First of all, I'd like to commend Senator French and the committees for your interest in considering this kind of an approach to a shifting towards a consumer-centered system of healthcare in this state. Whenever I go and talk about this to states that are interested in what Massachusetts did, the first thing I tell them is that you're not doing what Massachusetts did. What you're doing, maybe, is your version of some basic concepts that Massachusetts used. But you should not look at that specifically as a template in detail for what you're doing, because your state is very different and your problems are very different. And I have had people in other states point out the problems. You're not the only rural state that I've worked in point out that Massachusetts isn't a rural state, or like they say in California, well, they don't have 6 million illegal, you know, immigrants, or however many they have. Or in Louisiana, they say, well, they're a rich state and we're a poor state. And I said, you know, all of those things are true, and those are your problems, and you'll have to deal with them, but you don't have their problem. And people stop and say, well, what is their problem? Because the perception is they had everything going for them. In point of fact, Massachusetts has very high health care costs. Their problem is they have so many providers and so many prestigious providers and a culture that says, well, just because it says Harvard on it, you just pay the bill. Well, is it any good? Well, it says Harvard on it. Nobody ever thinks to question that. So they had a whole set of issues, and that's just with their delivery system. Then you have demographics, and this is before you even get to politics. So each state has to look at their own. Now let's talk, if I may, for a few minutes about the basic concept. The basic concept, as Senator French outlined it, is to shift what is today essentially a payer-driven system to a consumer-driven, in other words, a payer-centered to a consumer-centered. So what do I mean by a payer-centered? Well, basically in the hierarchy, you've got the payer on top, be the employer, or in the case of Medicaid or SCHIP, the government, or Medicare, the federal government, and then they may or may not be interacting with the insurer, who may or may not be interacting with the providers. They may go directly around the insurer, directly to the provider. Some state Medicaid programs do that, some large employer plans do that, etc. Over here on the side, with a dotted line, is the consumer. And they're the ones who, in theory, you're doing all this for, and they're the ones who are demanding everything, but they're not in control. They're not in charge. If you look at single-payer systems, that's what they are. They're a single payer. They're still a payer-centered system. Again, the consumer is off on the side, not control. I remember years ago a Canadian physician said, it's very easy to understand Canadian health care. It's like veterinary medicine. You take the dog to the vet, you talk to the vet about what's wrong with the dog, what the vet's going to do, how much the vet's going to charge, how you're going to pay, etc. The dog doesn't have a lot to say on the subject. I always use that, though, because how different is our system? It may be more privatized, but in fact, in terms of who's calling the shots, it's different. So the first and I think most important point, the point that you all to be congratulated on, is to recognize that a fundamental shift in the design of the system is what is needed to make a real difference. Simply cutting the number of payers down to one, aside from you know, Mr. Tanner's very valid points about the adverse effects of that in rationing and whatnot, it simply doesn't change the dynamic. So when you move to a consumer-centered system, the consumer is on top, The consumer picks the insurer interacts with the provider, or the consumer may interact with the provider directly, either purchasing directly, having a high deductible plan with an HSA, if that's their preference, et cetera. What happens is the payers, quote unquote, and it's not really that they're payers, because as Tanner pointed out, if the employer's putting the money in, it's really your wages. If the government's putting the money in, it's really your taxes. But they're over here on the side with a dotted line to the consumer, and that's what Senator French's bill would do, is to say they're here to help with them with the funding, but they're not here to run the system. Now, why would a state look to move to a consumer-centered model? The first and most important thing is it changes the incentives throughout the whole system. Everyone else now has to work for the consumer. And the second, and equally important in my mind, is it introduces a concept that you rarely hear in any discussion of healthcare. You hear a great deal about cost, you hear about access, maybe a little less so, but you hear about quality more and more these days. Sometimes you even hear about benefit. If you read, as I do, many of these discussions or studies or participate in these programs, you very rarely hear the word value. But value, I believe, is what's really key here, because value is the relationship between that cost and that benefit. And value is inherently subjective. It is inherently in the eye of the beholder. So I cannot make a value decision for you in purchasing a car for you or purchasing clothing for you. You may have a different equation than I do, and you most certainly will. It's very difficult for me to understand, and certainly to say that, well, let's just randomly pick all the people at the front of the room, that I'm going to make a decision for you as to the best value in your medical care. Well, I mean, we're only, what, six, seven, eight people? That would be impossible to eight. How are you going to do it with 800? It's very difficult to do that. Okay. So while it is inherently subjective, though, at some point, like beauty, value does rise to the level where we sort of recognize it when we see it or don't see it. Most people would agree that a Michelangelo painting is beautiful. Well, I think where we can all agree in the healthcare debate is we all have a sense, regardless of party or philosophy, we all have a sense that we're not getting a good value out of the system we've got today, either as individuals or collectively. And the way I put it is this way. We either feel like we're paying too much for what we're getting, or we're not getting enough for what we're paying. And ideally, we'd like to fix that, and really ideally, we'd like to pay less and get more. So the question is, how are you going to incentivize a system that rewards people for delivering that value better and cheaper? Because there are lots of ways to cut costs that don't produce value. The easiest way to control costs in healthcare is don't treat people. Every socialized system runs that way, and Medicare does some of that, and Medicaid as well. Oregon, you mentioned earlier. The second easiest way is, if you have to treat them, don't pay the provider. So we cut reimbursement rates. But that doesn't necessarily produce value. And we know that in the quality research, a lot of what goes on in healthcare is frankly wasted, or in fact downright dangerous. So the first, I think, and most important in my mind reason to move to a consumer-centered system is to create the right incentives to seek value and to reward those who provide value, whether they are doctors and hospitals or the insurance companies. And the insurance companies as intermediaries have to provide value. Are you there not to be a roadblock to me getting care or the doctor getting paid, but are you there to find me the best result at the best price? Because if not, I want to hire somebody else who will do that for me. I'm not an expert in all this. I need an agent. There are some other benefits as well. It makes it much easier to accommodate economic realities. We move to a system where where increasingly retirement savings attaches to the individual, not to the employer through the classic pension. Now, just like the old defined benefit pension plans, our health system and the tax code is, Tanner pointed out, that supports it, we're all premised on the idea of what the economy looked like about 1935, 1945. And that is, you turned 18, you got your high school diploma, and you went to work for a big company like General Electric or General Motors. You were there 30 years, they took care of you, and boom, we didn't have to have these government programs. The big employers would do it for you. Oh, you had a big union to represent you as well. Well, you know what, folks? That's not today's economy, and I think it's certainly not in Alaska. You have part-time workers, you have seasonal employees, you have people with two jobs, you have people moving jobs, and that's the dynamic part of the economy. As legislators, you want to encourage that, because that's where the jobs growth is going to be. That's where the economic vitality is. You don't want things that are a drag on it. A system where the insurance goes with the person deals with that. Just like we moved from defined benefit, we created 401ks, IRAs, SEP plans, simple plans for self-employed, all sorts of vehicles so people could take their retirement savings with them. That's the challenge for us in healthcare, to do the same sort of thing. The other thing that you will discover is when you look at the data on the uninsured nationally, and this is longitudinal data that's national, you can't really break it out by state, but you can kind of try to triangulate as we have done in some states. But when you look at the national data on the uninsured over time, you find that very few of these people are constantly uninsured. Over a four-year period, the data was found only 12% were uninsured the entire time, another 6% were uninsured almost all of the time, had some brief period of coverage. In contrast, one-third, 33%, went in and out of coverage repeatedly over a 48-month period. Another 29% had only one gap in their coverage at some point in that 4 months, and that gap was less than 24 months, less than half the time. So when you then look at that by income, the people who were predominantly covered, even though they had some experience with being uninsured over 4 years, were predominantly covered. The ones of those that were above 200% of poverty, that's about 41% nationally. And so the message to lawmakers is, look, if you've got the insurance to stick to the people instead of the jobs, this will vary depending on your state, but you know, plus or minus 40% of your problem might simply go away. If people stop losing insurance, we stop creating a lot of new uninsured people. That seems intuitively obvious, but we've been beating on this problem without thinking about it longitudinally for a long time. Now, that will vary from state to state. In a state like a Massachusetts or Maryland, you can do better than the national average, you know, 50%. In a state like Louisiana or Indiana, it would be less, maybe 33, 25, in Indiana or California, 25%. Louisiana, but even in a poor state like Louisiana, and I know one of our chairmen is from there, you know, and I've been working with the medical society down there on post-Katrina trying to reform that system. They're looking at something very similar. The medical society has been a huge advocate down there. I made like four or five, I could give you tours of Baton Rouge, I made about four or five trips down there. You know, they're saying, look, even in a poor state like that, if we can simply get the insurance to stick to people instead of the jobs, we can start to solve the problem, and then we can concentrate on the people that really need help, as Senator French points out, that need some subsidy to help them with their coverage. So there are a number of reasons why a state would want to do that. What you then get to is the questions of how do you get to that point. In the interest of time, I will not get into a great long detail. We have published a fair amount on this. I continue to publish more on this. I work with state legislators on working through. As I said, each state you have to do it in your own way. But let me just give you a couple of quick points. With regards to the drafting issues that I see in SB 160, and Mr. Tanner pointed out some of them, the requirements on the employers, I would simply not bother with that. Not only do I agree with the economics, Mr. Tanner pointed out, but as a matter of law, if you're trying as a state to require employers to do things, you're simply going to run into federal law and ERISA, and you know, you're just wasting your effort. You're beating your head against the wall. You're just going to have to live with it and work around with it. The state cannot regulate the employer is basically what it says. I mean, there's a lot of fine points buried under that. The thing you have to understand about Massachusetts is that was a that there are provisions in there that says employers have to do things. They were artfully designed to be a political compromise that had no meaningful effect on a business. So what it meant, as somebody said, look, there are employer mandates in the bill. If but it's an IQ test for employers. If you can't read the bill and figure out how to get out from under them, you're probably not bright enough to be in business in the first place. All you have to do is go down and sign up for your employees to have tax-free payroll withholding through a Section 125, and boom, the mandates don't apply to you. Look, you know, it was kind of a kabuki theater. The legislature insisted on it, the governor vetoed it, the legislature overrode the veto. If you've noticed, nobody's filed a court case, and that's because nobody's being affected. They just got out from under it. If anybody did file a court case, it would be thrown out. My advice to other states is don't even go there. You know, it's not worth the effort. On the issue of the low-income premium support, the important thing, and I think this addresses some of Mr. Tanner's concern, to understand about what Massachusetts did, is it is not an entitlement approach, and I would strongly encourage states to look at that as well as a defined amount of money, not an entitlement. In other words, it is not a situation that says, you know, number of people times income level times dollar amount at that level equals what we're committed to spending. What it says is we have an amount of money to spend, and this is the target population we want to spend it on. And how can we make the money go the furthest? That's very important. That's a very different approach, and that is how the Massachusetts thing works, and that's how it forces the legislature and the executive branch to rethink this as issues come up. Another point is with respect to the health plan standards. Again, Massachusetts, I think you can learn from the prototype. It made the job unnecessarily complicated for itself in giving the connector authority over some of these health plan standards. The reality is that unlike the federal government or unlike a private employer, a state government does regulate insurance. So what you do is you say, look, this is the standards for the insurance to be sold. Anything that meets those standards, sold by a company that it meets the standards applied to companies to do business in the state, is acceptable. Now, what should those standards be? You can start with a minimum, which is anything that is compliant with federal law, ERISA, and HIPAA, Health Insurance Affordability Act. That's very basic. You may or may not add things to there. If you have mandates, that's a good way to just say, let's start with a clean slate. Anything that meets those standards. You have an insurance department. There's no need to duplicate it. There's no need to put it elsewhere. Simply say they are the ones who regulate the products in the same way that the Securities and Exchange Commission regulates the offering of stocks, not the New York Stock Exchange. They just handle the transactions. So those are the issues that I think you would have to go back and revise. The other points that I would simply make is there is a sort of logic to this, and you start by saying, in a consumer-centered world, what do we want the insurance to look like? And that's the first part. The mechanism of an exchange or authority to administer it, that's kind of at the end. The question of, well, do we make people buy it or do something else, that's at the end. That's not the beginning. The first question is, what do we want the insurance market to look like? And you have two markets today. You have a group and an individual market. They have their strengths and they have their weaknesses. Where you start is, and where this concept is different, is to say, we're going to create a hybrid market. We're going to take the best of both. So what do we like from the individual market? Well, we like that it's personal and it's portable, right? But what do we not like about it? Well, the issue of pre-existing conditions. I mean, Mr. Tanner's right, if somebody's never had insurance, but what happens if you had insurance and now you want to switch policies? I mean, you can't have a consumer choice market if you're locked into a plan. So you have to be able to switch policies. Now, that's guaranteed issue, but that has limits on it. Oh, you can't do it any time. You can only do it once a year at open season, for example. So you put some parameters. We say we're going to have a market where we've got the personal and portable ownership, consumer ownership that we like from the individual market, but we've got the tax advantages that we like from the small group market, and we've got the sort of set of familiar rules and regulations. You know, once a year you get to make a choice kind of thing. So that's what you're doing, is you're creating a hybrid market, you're offering it to employers, and then the exchange becomes a mechanism, an administrative system, like a large health human resources department, for handling matching up the people, the plans, the dollars, et cetera. Now, what states then discovered, as Massachusetts did, and as you're considering, is that there's an added advantage. The state now has one place to sort of send extra money as a subsidy and doesn't have to do all those other things. It doesn't have to design a plan. It doesn't have to run a plan. It doesn't have to track all these people down or try to buy them into separate plans. It has one place. And so Massachusetts went from writing three checks, in a sense, for uncompensated care to three hospital systems to 150,000 checks to 150,000 different people who are all working and worked for thousands of different employers. Well, they had one place to do it. And so it made much easier moving people out of public program and into quality private insurance where they have a choice of coverage. Now, again, they had to do their own transitional issues and their own peculiarities related to the way Massachusetts was, the way they were trying to go, and the politics of what you could get done. Each state is going to be different on that. Other states are looking at going further and saying, well, we have these existing programs for these people, people who say have children that qualify for the children's health program. Why not simply make that an extra contribution to the parents' policies? There are a lot of creative things that you can do with that, and you can get beyond that to deal with some of your other issues, such as in your case, some of the rural health issues. In Massachusetts' case, it was setting up a separate cost and quality commission. That was their issue. But that's something probably for another day. Thank you very much for the time and for your attention and for inviting me here.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your presentation. Comments or questions for Mr. Hazelmayer? Senator French, and then I have one as well. Go ahead.
Thank you. You wrote, I think, very well about the one of the more controversial aspects of the Massachusetts plan is the individual mandate, the sort of the obligation on a person to actually go out and purchase a health insurance policy. And I wonder if you can comment on that. You pointed out one of your writings about how Governor Romney pointed out that allowing people to go without health insurance when they can expect someone else to pay the tab for their treatment is essentially a de facto mandate on providers and taxpayers. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. Well, that's a good jumping off point for pointing out how Governor Romney approached it, because he did not approach it again as the first thing. It was the last thing, not the first thing. The first thing was he said, look, I'm going to make insurance more affordable. He asked the legislature to repeal the mandates. In the end, they didn't. They agreed not to put any more on. They stripped out the ones that were added during the process. And they did provide for mandate elimination in plans for young, healthy people. And they did provide for an expansion of HSA plans. And they did provide for selective contracting by providers and wellness discounts. These were all things that were not there. So they did make some changes. But his first point was, I'm going to make insurance less expensive, as Tanner pointed out, for middle-class people. Secondly, I'm going to make it easier for people to get. And that was the whole concept of the connector. The employer doesn't have to sponsor a plan. All they do is they say, the connector's going to be my plan. What are the benefits? Whatever you pick that are state regulated individual policies within the connector. So I'm going to make it less expensive, I'm going to make it easier to get, and then third, we're going to subsidize it. We're going to take the money, or most of the money that's going to the hospitals with no transparency or accountability in Massachusetts to treat those people, and we're going to identify the people and we're going to provide them with a subsidy. So he did those things first. He said, because to mandate it in this market would be wrong and counterproductive. First we do those three things, then we say, okay folks, you're out of excuses for not having it. Now, what he then said is, he said, look, I'm not going to make you have it, but if you insist on not having it, then we want to make sure that you pay your bills. So they did a couple of things. They said that people had to either put up a bond or put money in an escrow account. They have a state income tax. They said if you didn't do that, we would hold back your refunds and fill up the escrow account, which, by the way, we pay you interest. In effect, it's a forced HSA, if you will, as a solution. But they also made it easier for the providers to collect. Because there's kind of a game of chicken going on here. Yeah, well, I don't pay the bill, and then I'll make you look bad if you try to collect from a poor, you know, big, mean hospital picking on poor person. Yeah. This is, by the way, the difference between uncompensated care and bad debt. In theory, bad debt is people who can pay but don't. And there was a lot of that going on in Massachusetts. They found that a lot of, it was supposed to be uncompensated care, but there was a lot of bad debt. So he made it easier for the providers to collect, provide for automatic garnishment of wages, things like that. Now, the legislature didn't go along with it. They changed a lot of stuff, you know, but you guys do that sort of thing when governors propose things. And the legislature said, look, buy a policy or we fine you on your added to your income tax, a fine equal to half the value of an average policy. That doesn't start this year, it kicks in next year. So it will take a couple of years. This is all being phased in over a couple of years. So, you know, the bite doesn't come yet. People will start, the thinking is people will start to become really aware of it around the end of this year. That was their way of doing it. My point on this is that there is an inherent trade-off, and this reflects on what Mr. Tanner said. There is a trade-off between the way the parameters you set for the insurance and the need for the mandate. If, for example, the insurance that you allow to be sold through it is age and geography adjusted, then it becomes a much better value for younger, healthier people to buy. And therefore, the need to require people to do it is much less. And you can probably get most of those people simply by putting the choice in front of them once a year and asking them to fill out a piece of paper. The trade-off, though, is that you are going to have to address risk concerns that the insurers have with separate legislation for reinsurance. It's like a high risk pool, but a risk transfer pool where instead of sending people over to a pool, you send the claims over and they're evenly distributed. Now, in Massachusetts, they had community rating, and I don't advocate that anywhere, though I would point out that employer plans today are in effect community rated. They had community rating, and politically they weren't going to change. Well, that means that you invert that equation, because you've artificially overpriced the product for younger, healthier people. Your concerns about, you know, somebody picking Blue Cross versus Aetna versus Harvard Pilgrim, and Harvard Pilgrim is going to be less, they're going to be less worried that they're going to get all the sick people into that sort of world. So the need for risk adjustment or risk transfer pool is less, and Massachusetts did include one. But you really have to make the healthy 23-year-olds buy it. So there is a trade-off there, and that's something to consider. I mean, my preference, and this is what we did in the original draft of the District of Columbia, was to say, look, it's age-adjusted rating. Geography was irrelevant there. It's age-adjusted rating, but we have a risk transfer pool to accompany it to make sure to address those concerns that the carriers have of, well, I'm afraid I might get, you know, a disproportionate share of the diabetics once people can pick and choose. And at the end of the day, you know, that kind of selection in a properly designed market might actually be a good thing. I mean, think about it. If you're an insurer and you're really good at getting the best results at the best price for cancer care, it would be a good thing if all the people with cancer went to you. But if you have to charge standard rates, then you've got to make it up somewhere else. The funding mechanisms for those are the same as what you would do for a high-risk pool.
Thank you, Senator French. I want to go online and see if there are any questions or comments from Senator Stevens, Representative Wilson, or Senator Elton at this time. If so, please speak up. If not, I'll ask.
Mr. Chair, this is Kim, and I've been here taking notes, and it's been a good hearing so far, so thanks.
Okay. If any of you want to jump in, please just go ahead and interrupt. Mr. Hazelmeyer, you mentioned, you're talking about the various aspects of the consumer-driven system, and that has a lot of attraction for us here. And my conception of a truly consumer-driven system would depend on consumers to be better, more efficient, more intelligent consumers of healthcare resources. And so I wondered if you've given thought to how we educate people to be better consumers of healthcare, to know which provider, is it government's role to educate people about which provider charges a reasonable rate compared to the higher charger? In Alaska, we don't have a lot of healthcare choices because of our practical things here in our state. So shopping around is not a big opportunity for most Alaskans the way it may be elsewhere. But how do we, because a lot of experts I've read say that there is a lot of savings to be made in consumers being smarter about where they have their surgical procedures performed or whatever. For most of us, flying to Seattle is the cheap option.
Right. Well, and you're absolutely right about that. I mean, this is not the only state in that situation. In South Dakota, once you get outside of Sioux Falls, it's the same sort of thing. Is there a hospital? That's the question. The answer is a couple of things. One, for some of these procedures, you're already doing that flying here. The question is, are you flying to the right place? Okay. Two, one of the things that I always try to encourage lawmakers is when you're doing this, you want to do it with as little, with the right regulations or the right laws, but as little as necessary to do the trick. So the second point is that simply creating the ability for people to choose changes the market dynamic in ways that other players in the market have to respond. And I will caution you, this will be unsettling. Okay, and this is one of the other lessons from Massachusetts, is you have to work through this together with your stakeholders, and they have to understand how they're going to come out at the other end. But let's be clear about this. You are fundamentally shifting from a seller-driven market to a buyer-driven market. That is what you're doing if you did this. Right now, the insurers and the brokers are it's seller-driven. Okay, the brokers represent the insurers. There's a difference in real estate between the agent working for the seller and the agent working for the buyer. There's a difference in stocks. There's a difference in anything. You are fundamentally saying that from now on, everybody else in the system works for the consumer as the buyer. Now, what happens when you make that fundamental choice? Suddenly, you have created a demand. Which plan should I pick? Which provider should I go to? That's the next question. Who is going to help me to decide? Well, there's still a role for those experts out there. The broker can still help you. The broker can still get paid to help you. But now they're helping you in a different way. They're helping you say, well, what's the best plan? Now, we do have experience in this area. The Federal Employee Health Benefits Program has run this way since 1960. The government, as an employer, doesn't design the benefit packages by and large. What it does is it invites carriers in, and people pick and choose. And what you found is that a whole bunch of private entities have sprung up to help people make those choices. I had a gentleman, I have no idea why, sent something to the general email at Heritage saying that he worked for the IRS, he was about to retire, he really liked his FEHBP coverage, and he wanted to know what he should do now that he was going to be 65 and in Medicare, and how did that interact? Well, I didn't know the answer, but what I did know is that Washington Consumer Checkbook, which is like Consumers Reports, a nonprofit, independent, doesn't take money from companies. Washington Consumer Checkbook has annually published for many years the Guide to Federal Employee Health Benefits Program, and I knew that there's a whole section in there for people like him, a whole chapter. In fact, I know the guy who writes this, and every year it gets thicker and better with more comparative information. So I sent him an email back saying, you know, what you want is the guide, you want to look it up. And then just to be extra helpful, I went online to find their website. So I could send him the link. And lo and behold, when I found their website, I found that his employer, the U.S. Treasury Department, had purchased a bulk subscription for every one of their employees. So he didn't even have to pay for this information. He could just simply go online and enter the number and get the information. The National Association of Retired Federal Employees, you know, they do the same sort of thing. And one of them was quoted saying, look, there's no such thing as a bad FEHBP plan. They're just different plans for different people. So the second point is really that a lot of this can come about on its own without you having to do it. Now, finally, yes, states could do it. In the case of Massachusetts, they are doing some of that if they thought it was useful to do that, to collect and publish the information. My advice to anyone, public or private, doing that, and I think a lot of my colleagues in health policy share it, is if you're going to do that, don't try to design the ideal system first, because you'll never get there. What you do is take the information you have, put it out there, and then invite everybody who is affected by it to come in and help you improve it. Because, you know, the minute you start doing quality comparisons, every physician, every hospital will say, well, yeah, but you got to adjust for the fact that I get the sick patients, not the other doctors. You know, every insurer will tell you, yes, but I do a better job of managing claims, not other people. I mean, there's certain things that you can do, just put it out there. you know, and you could have some basic information. For example, rather than set a loss ratio that insurers have to, in other words, the portion that isn't the premium that isn't paid for claims but goes to everything else, rather than set an arbitrary amount, just publish what they do and let them buy it down at the end of the year before you do the statistics. That way, you know, if they want to make their numbers look better, they can refund money to policyholders. Works for me.
Scherzel, Mayor, I ask you if you will relinquish a little bit of your time here to the time constraint.
I'm longer than
next presenter, and we can have you guys back when questions arise for either of you. Thank you again for your presentation.
Thank you.
So if there are other questions, I apologize. We'll get back to it. Let's move quickly to Mr. Jeff Ram. He's been with us before. He has a time constraint. Jeff, come on forward. He's the president of the Alaska Association of Health Underwriters and a broker with Wallace Group Services. The AAHU, the state chapter of the National Association of Health Underwriters in D.C., is an advocacy association with the objective of improving the health, financial, and retirement security needs of all Americans through education, advocacy, and professional development. Our staff has done a good job with these introductions. Jeff, thanks for being with us. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Senator Elf. And I want to thank Senator French for inviting me again to testify before your committee. I want to make a few comments in relation to SB 160. We feel that our organization feels that this is going down the right path and that we agree wholeheartedly that this addresses a true need in the state of Alaska. The one thing I might say is that what Mr. Tanner said earlier about that the solution really does lie in Washington, D.C., I don't agree with. I think Alaska is an incredibly diverse state, and we need to recognize that diversity and recognize that we have needs in this state that can only be answered by the citizens of the state. So from that, I'll be making my comments. We agree that in addressing this program and monitoring the insurers involved in the process, bring forth quality and affordable products and to monitor the Alaska Health Fund, which has been described in SB 160. We feel that it's about time that the issue be brought forth to address the most serious issue in our state. And for that, I commend the Senator for taking the first big step. The areas we feel moving down this path are the board that would be created, the Alaska Healthcare Board, is a crucial element for the success of SB 160. Or whatever bill evolves out of this whole process, that the board must have the authority to make the hard decisions along with solid recommendations. I think that that's what's been lacking over the years in trying to put something like this together, is that we've had a lot of people that have been on committees, on commissions and whatnot, that have no real feel for what's going on in the healthcare world. The group would have to include employers, providers such as hospitals, physicians, federally funded program officials, public health officials, state chamber officials, the insurance industry, legislative members, and of course executive branch members, that the board has a clear and concise agenda capable of making unbiased decisions based on the true needs of the state of Alaska. One of the biggest problems we have in our healthcare system is that everyone in the system is protecting its own turf. We're not going in any general one direction, we're going in 10 different directions. And in doing so, we're not accomplishing anything because everybody is protecting what they are doing. That we establish what is truly driving the cost of healthcare. I think that's one of the things that's missing, is that I don't believe that we as a society truly understand what is driving the cost. I think, yes, the uninsured is causing a significant amount of cost shifting. However, that is just the beginning. Aging population and longevity is developing into a huge cost, with the 75-80 million baby boomers evolving into retirement, and the projected in 10 years spending on the elderly will be $1.8 trillion in this country, about half of the federal budget. Medicare and Medicaid combined costs are projected to be $1.2 trillion by 2015, up from $473 billion in 2005. So So there's a huge cost shift alone in that area. Pharmaceutical costs, there's no surprise here, $224 billion in 2005 to $521 billion in 2014. There's another issue to answer one of the questions that was asked earlier. New technologies that in the end prolong life, so it ends up keeping us alive longer. Spending on technology is not going away anytime soon, and it accounts for about 20% of the growth in healthcare spending. System inefficiencies, duplication of procedures and overuse of high-end procedures, defensive medicine. The cost of medical malpractice since 1975 has outpaced all other types of liability insurance, rising at an average of 11.7% versus 9% for all other tort issues. The lack of managed care in the state of Alaska is a gigantic issue. It is no secret that the cost to receive, you mentioned it before, services has a much bigger price tag in the state of Alaska than it does in the lower 48. I provided in my previous testimony some specific examples of differences between Alaska and Washington. If we had the choice to choose and it was easier to go across state lines to get health care, I'm sure that we probably would do that. But to make the 3.5-hour flight and a $600 price tag to go down to Seattle is not realistic for most people. My point is, once we understand what is driving costs, it'll be easier to determine what will cost to cover the uninsured. We cannot kid ourselves that the number will be moderate, because the uninsured do not need as much as those that are uninsured, that are insured. The cost will be exceedingly high. The biggest concern that we have is, where is the money going to come from? How are we going to fund this? That's a big question. I haven't heard that, and I know that Senator French is intending on bringing forth as to how all that is going to happen through various sources, but that is something that that needs to be answered. And though Massachusetts is considered a preliminary success, I do think we have a long ways to go. As mentioned before, Massachusetts has not succeeded yet. They still have a long ways to go, and it'll be interesting to see where that ends up. The last thing I was going to say is that I don't believe that if this goes through that we will actually see a decrease in premiums. I do think that if we can accomplish this and we can see a moderate increase in premiums versus the 15% trend that we see in the state of Alaska, that in my mind would be a gigantic step forward in accomplishing what we're trying to accomplish here. And those are all my comments for now. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Mr. Ramp, thank you very much for your presentation. I remember working on this issue 18 years ago, and representatives from the, we were promoting a single-payer approach at the time, and for lots of policy reasons, and the insurance industry folks on the other side of the table beat us senseless and opposed us at every step. And so it's very gratifying here two decades later to have a productive conversation with folks in your line of work and policymakers to try and grapple together. You know, we have a very similar goal. How can we do this in an Alaskan fashion to meet the needs of our citizens? So thank you for being willing to talk about it. Before, the folks knew they had the power to do a big thumbs down on any change at the state level in healthcare reform. That's not been your attitude. You've been a constructive, positive voice, and we want to continue that with you.
Thank you very much.
Any quick questions? Representative Gatto.
Quickly, if we had a system where everyone got 100% of the cost of the proposed doctor for any time, any reason, regardless, in the end, would that be good for the country or the state or whoever we're involved with? Would that be devastating, or is that something like we're doing now almost, because everybody wants to go completely, needs to go anyway?
Well, I don't know if this is going to answer your question, but anybody that wants to go that doesn't have insurance right now, as Senator Ellis has pointed out, goes to the emergency room, and Mr. Tanner pointed out as well, go to the emergency room. The cost of doing that is exceedingly high. I believe that if we feel that by covering the uninsured is going to be a moderate price, I think that Massachusetts proved that out. It was I think, and I might be wrong about the statistic, but I thought I read the statistic, it was twice as much as they thought it was going to be in terms of providing that coverage. I don't think it's going to be a cheap price tag. I think once these everybody has coverage, I think the costs are going to be high. I think one of the reasons I didn't mention that, believe that the healthcare is so expensive in this country, isn't because of our healthcare system. It isn't because of that. It's because we're an unhealthy nation. We're not as healthy as other nations are. And I think that's what's driving a lot of this, is that if you look at all the other countries that we have looked at, all the things that I have read, we're just simply not a healthy country. Our longevity is a miracle, I think, for a lot of us. I don't know if I answered your question or not.
Surprised at the ending there.
Other comments or questions? If not, Mr. Ram, thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you for slipping me in on.
Yes, and the materials as well are excellent. Next, we proceed to the Department of Health and Social Services. Have some comments for us. I believe Pat Carr, Alice Rarig are online. As you're coming forward there at the teleconference site, I personally see some great opportunities for some synergy and cooperation between Governor Palin's initiative in healthcare issues with her task force and with the work here in the legislature. At least I'm sure that's my attitude and the attitude of the other sponsors, is to try and see how we can work together between the executive and legislative branches. So if you all are there, please go ahead with your presentation. Pat Carr, Alice Rearing.
Senator Ellis, this is Pat Carr. I think we would defer our comments. We acknowledged early on that we would be online. We do not have prepared comments to make at this point. Thank you. If the commissioner is, Commissioner Jackson is there, perhaps she may want to make some comments at this point.
Oh, I didn't know the commissioner was here. Commissioner, please come forward. I just, working with what was put in front of me here. So, Commissioner, my apologies. We should have introduced you at the outset. But
no problem. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Davis. And we apologize for you're not getting the message that we're here. For the record, Carlene Jackson, Commissioner for Health and Social Services. With me, I have Dr. Jay Butler, who's our Chief Medical Officer. And we'll make just very brief comments. I know your agenda mentions the Department of the Physician on this bill. What we'd like to say at this point is our position is we're very grateful to Senator French for bringing this forward and for us being able to have a conversation, but we're not prepared to take an actual position on the different points of the bill. What we would like to do is comment on a few of those and perhaps to raise a few more questions for the conversation.
Sure.
We really appreciate the expert testimony that's come along, particularly Mr. Hazelmayer talking about the value that we need to be looking at in terms of cost-benefit. And as we work through the pieces of this bill, I know that's something we'll all be focusing on. As was mentioned, the Governor's Health Council, which Senator Davis is an ex officio member of, is also working on identifying strategies, both short and long term, to help balance our health care system in terms of access, cost, and quality. And certainly this bill and this conversation are a part of moving towards that. We expect that when the Health Council finishes its work in January and presents their recommendations, that may help inform this bill's work, as well as several other bills that are out there. Some specifics to SB 160, we are doing some fiscal note analysis, as well as other departments doing some analysis. Those are not all completed at this point in time, but we expect we'll have future conversations about that as well. Many of the questions that I had about this bill have been raised by some of the other speakers. Mr. Tanner brought up the point of the employee mandates and the individual mandates. Those would also be concerns that we would want to have more of a conversation about. Also, I think Mr. Ramp did a great job of talking about Alaska being unique, and we need to be careful in crafting our program that it's something that works for Alaska, that we're not overly reliant on federal funding or federal policies. And if we look at our SCHIP program right now in Congress and the fact that they're still deciding what's going to happen with that program nationally, that will have an impact on this bill and on other things that we might do. So I would caution us about that. Another question that I would have is, can we make sure as we're working through whatever bills we have that access is not just an insurance card, but actual access to health care for Alaskans? And that's something I know that we'll all be having conversations about as time goes on. Also, one of the concerns with this specific bill is the way the board is structured. It sits in the Department of Health as a division. And I would suggest that you might want to look at some other models like the Mental Health Trust Authority, which is a board that's basically a quasi-governmental agency that does not sit in a department with a board having oversight of a division, but has a board having oversight of that specific structure. So a healthcare board might have a similar kind of a model. I think this is especially important given that the Department of Administration has the Division of Insurance, and they also have responsibility for the state health benefit plan. So that's a little out of the purview of the Department of Health, although we certainly work collaboratively with a board like that, as we do with the Mental Health Trust Board. That's a really fast analysis. I'm going to give Dr. Butler an opportunity to add his comments. And then I'm going to apologize in advance. I have to leave by 3:15, but Dr. Butler will be here for the duration of your meeting and can answer any of the questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Dr. Butler?
Thank you. I have only two very brief general comments. I don't see on the agenda, I haven't heard today yet, any representation of a perspective that a physician might bring, and I cannot be so presumptuous as to suggest that I represent the point of view of all of my colleagues, but I did want to point out this past January, the American Medical Association, the American College of Physicians, a number of other professional organizations published criteria for a well-functioning healthcare system. And those criteria included an imperative for providing care for all, responsible stewardship of community resources, and the importance of personal responsibility. The second general point that I'd like to make is that it's worth noting that it will probably be impossible to really reduce costs and improve the health of Alaskans unless we also place a premium and an emphasis on prevention. Thank you.
Comments or questions?
Dr. Butler, an interesting point. I was talking to my primary care physician, and I said, you know, we have an idea that we might require you to provide some free health care to some individuals, military or something. And she looked at me like she was going to hit me. And we're dealing with this all the time, is how do we get new physicians to come up here, much less are we going to scare the ones here and drive them away? So part of the equation is, we can't just keep penalizing the physicians, or we won't have enough, and we already don't have enough, but it'll become even worse. And doesn't that become a significant contribution to the entire formula of how we apportion health care?
Yes, I could respond to that. It's estimated that currently there is a fairly profound and rapidly escalating shortage of healthcare providers, including physicians and nurses in the state of Alaska, and that issue has been studied. There's not easy answers. There actually are shortages of physicians in other parts of the country. I think Alaska may have some particular challenges. The Call of the North only goes so far, and getting physicians who've trained outside interested in coming to Alaska is not always easy. The available data suggests that one of the most powerful predictors of where physicians will take up practice is where they've completed their residency training. This time, there's only really one residency training program in Alaska, the family practice program based in Providence Hospital here in Alaska, here in Anchorage.
Not the Native Hospital either?
There's not a residency program. They do have rotations for residents from other programs, though.
If there's nothing else, Commissioner, and Doctor, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Yep. A long road ahead for your task force and our work together. I'd like to note as we proceed that for some time now, staffer to Senator Lyman Hoffman has been with us. He's a member of the Labor and Commerce Committee, and Sandy Berg is taking notes for Senator Hoffman. Let's call Dwayne Hyman forward at this time. Dwayne is the Executive Director of Commonwealth North Alaska Healthcare Roundtable, very innovative private sector group. The Roundtable is a consortium of Alaska corporations, healthcare organizations, and healthcare stakeholders that include many of Alaska's largest employers, key stakeholders in this debate. Dwayne, thanks for being here. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Senator Ellis, Senator French, Senator Davis, and other members of the panel. Thank you for addressing this important issue. The Alaska Healthcare Roundtable, which is a Commonwealth North project, has been working on these issues for for 2 years now, so we have a degree of empathy with you. It sprang from a 2005 study that we had, which was Alaska Primary Healthcare Challenges and Opportunities, and given Commonwealth North's longstanding focus on statewide economic and asset management issues, the roundtable brings a strong economic and business perspective to these discussions. And we also hope that Senate Bill 160 will be a catalyst to focus attention on the health of Alaskans, how it can be improved, and how we can offer quality and access to all Alaskans in an affordable, effective manner. To help your deliberations, we have given you a copy of the document we won't have time to go through today, but it is something that we have also given the Governor's Healthcare Strategies Planning Council, and it's called Principles, Elements, and Specific Steps to begin to introduce some elements to work with. It offers guidelines for creating effective specific action steps, includes building blocks for a better system, suggests immediate steps to consider, and highlights some pseudo reform myths or things to avoid. Now that many states are experimenting with healthcare reform, and it will be a central issue, I think, this year in the upcoming U.S. presidential elections, Alaska has the opportunity to learn from all of this activity and avoid unnecessary, unintended consequences. I would suggest that 2 points are germane. One has already been made today: above all, do no harm. Most commentators agree that significant reforms are needed, but they shouldn't be a detriment to the majority of people that already have reasonable access to health care. And secondly, that insurance and coverage is only part of the ultimate solution. The real goal is healthy Alaskans, not just insurance coverage. And improving the health of Alaskans is a long-term, multifaceted situation of which insurance is one part, an important part at that. And as we have in the past, the roundtable is ready to work with you and others to try and help get the best ideas out on the table so that we can find solutions that fit the unique needs of our state.
Trimon, thank you for your presentation and your leadership in this area. Are there any comments or questions? Senator French.
While we have you here, Dwayne, thank you for being here. And I guess my question for you is, as your members in the roundtable sort of discuss this idea of universal health care, which approaches do you think there's any consensus on amongst your members?
Well, I think we think more in terms of universal access to health care. And one of the things that keeps coming back is the totality of the situation, that insurance is definitely part of it, access is part of it, but if you aren't aware of an alternative, if you physically can't get there, if you can't afford to utilize the service, it won't help, as well as other ways of just maintaining a healthier lifestyle, because prevention ultimately is the best way to try and stem the increase in cost.
Dwayne, I mentioned my little trip down memory lane about 20 years ago, trying a government approach with single payer, and now Senator French is leading the way with a market, consumer-based approach that seems to have better traction with a lot of Alaskans and the business community in particular. And 20 years ago, the business community in Alaska basically said, not interested, get lost, world market forces haven't impinged upon our bottom line, and what other countries are doing isn't really a concern. And now 20 years, and I always said at the time that we'd never make any progress until the business community asked us as Republicans and Democrats in the legislature to do something. And I think we've come to that day with many businesses in this state. So I appreciate you sort of managing that debate among your members and bringing those voices forward, because it's crucial to us making any progress together. But it's a world of change. I mean, I have waited many years for the business community to come forward and say, we need help, a different kind of approach than maybe in previous iterations, but people saying that it's time to, that we can do better in this state and in this country. And the business community is crucial to that, obviously. And So I appreciate your leadership in that regard.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Okay, let's go on to Lael Fairbairn, managing partner of the Snow City Cafe. Lael, if you're here, please come forward. For the record, and our members, Snow City Cafe is a successful downtown restaurant. The cafe has worked hard to provide meaningful health benefits for employees. And Jesse Collins, an employee of Snow City, will also share a few words during Lael's, or following Lael's testimony. So to both of you, welcome. We appreciate your presence here today.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and Chair Davis, members of the committee, my name is Lael Fairbairn. I'm the managing partner of Snow City Cafe, a very popular breakfast and lunch spot. Voted best breakfast for the last 5 years by we're located downtown at the corner of 4th Avenue and L Street. Senator French, thank you very much for inviting me to speak to the committee. I am very excited to be here because I feel that Senate Bill 160 is a very promising solution to a significant problem faced by a large number of Alaska businesses. Snow City has been in business for 9.5 years. Started on a shoestring, we are now a thriving concern. Still, even though we do an incredible amount of business, health insurance for our employees remains out of reach, and not by a little, but by a lot. I have been trying to obtain coverage for our employees since soon after we first opened. At first, it wasn't just about paying for insurance, it was about getting someone to cover us. We had an employee diagnosed with testicular cancer in fall 2002. 1 year later, after treatment, he was considered to be cancer-free, but we couldn't find anyone to cover us. The insurance broker we worked with suggested that we get coverage for just our managers and then expand the group later, because carriers cannot refuse to cover a group once it's been insured, even if the parameters for the group have changed. A plan for just our four managers was $24,000, which was more than twice what we could all obtain coverage individually. Finally, after many stops and starts, we found coverage for $216 per employee, which we were thrilled to find. With the 20 employees that we could get to agree to pay 50% of that premium, because 75% of all the eligible employees had to agree to participate, we expected to pay a premium of about $30,000 that first year. If we had that policy still, we would be paying more than $62,000 a year based on a 20% annual increase we were told to expect if the same number of employees were participating. We were willing to deal with those increases because we know how important health insurance is. After we made our first payment to start this coverage, we had our premium double after the insurance company reviewed our employee medical histories. Even if the cafe could afford to pay 50% of the increased premium, our employees couldn't or wouldn't pay the increase. Many of them are young and feel they're never going to get sick or hurt, so insurance is a luxury to them. Until they end up in the emergency room with appendicitis or with testicular cancer, as two of our former employees did. Hearing the news of the double premium was one of the saddest days I've had being in business. I was so proud of us for finally being able to offer this benefit, and I knew it would truly help our employees, but ultimately I had to tell them we wouldn't be able to do it after all. I estimate that based on our current number of employees and the astronomic cost of insurance that we would be paying almost $90,000 a year in premiums. Now, instead of that, we sort of self-insure. Each employee has a $250 a year allowance for reimbursing medical expenses. Our hope is that employees will use it to get a dental checkup or annual exam. Many eligible employees don't even use this, so we use the leftover money to help out employees on an as-needed basis for any special medical issues. And then all five of our managers receive a $300 per month bonus to pay for their individual policies because it's so much more cost-effective for them to purchase it themselves than for us to purchase it. One of our employees that we help with his medical bills is Jesse Collins, who is here with me to talk about his experience with health insurance since he turned 19 and is no longer eligible for denial to kid care.
Thanks for having us here and thanks for listening to me this afternoon. My birthday was in January and I dropped out of Denali Kid Care, and I'm diabetic, type 1, diagnosed 3 years ago. And once I dropped out of Denali Kid Care, I started paying anywhere from $350 to $400 a month just for my diabetic supplies. And it's been over a year since I've had an eye exam. I can't afford it. I'm actually working two jobs right now, working Snow City full-time, and then I've got 24 hours over at the Bearstooth, which they offer, Bearstooth, about $90 a month. They'll cover me, and but they don't cover pre-existing conditions for the first 12 months, which would be diabetes for me. And I've been online looking through with insurance companies. Blue Cross is one of them. They would not cover me at all. So then I go with another small organization called Achia, who tries to cover everyone who's been kind of rejected. They're starting at $437 a month, and for the first 6 months, they will not cover any pre-existing conditions. So I'm kind of stuck in a pickle right now because it's hard for me to financially pay for everything. And luckily, I've had help from Lael in reimbursements.
Not having health insurance, some of my employees will use the emergency room as their regular health care provider. Others will not go to the doctor until we won't let them come to work without a doctor's note. Snow City Cafe would be happy to pay a percentage of our payroll, as the bill proposes, to help fund this program. It would be far less than any health insurance that we could purchase right now. Senate Bill 160 is an incredible opportunity for our state, a potential legacy on par with the permanent fund. I'm so energized and optimistic that there's progress on this issue and the possibility for our state to join other forward-looking states such as Massachusetts, Oregon, and California and provide health care for everyone. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lael and Jesse. We appreciate you being here today. Are there any comments or questions for these folks? Senator Davis.
I just want to say that I appreciate you coming forward, and I want to congratulate you on your care and attitude and what you're doing for your employees. I'm sure that other people can benefit from just hearing what you're saying and might want to join forces with you to make us provide the insurance that your employer that might need.
Thank you. I hope so.
And Lael, we know how busy you are running a going concern there, and congratulations on your success. But if you ever have an opportunity in the chamber or the Rotary or any small business groups in town to sort of carry your message and talk to folks and spread the word, it would be very helpful.
Thank you. I was reluctant to talk about not being able to provide health insurance for our employees because I did have a customer at one time when we threw a big fundraiser for our employee who had testicular cancer. When we were promoting that, we had a customer say, shame on you for not providing health insurance. And I think there's a lot of ignorance out there for people that do get health insurance covered through, you know, state agency or, you know, a large employer. They don't understand, and so it is hard for us small businesses to wave the flag and say, yes, we don't offer it right now, and you know, it's hard when they see us as busy as we are, but you have to sell a lot of Eggs Benedicts to come up with $90,000 extra, you know, so.
Yes. Senator French.
Just briefly, and thank you, Lael and Jesse, for being here today. You know, as we develop the bill, really small businesses and young people are the particularly difficult segments of the population to get covered. The economics are very hard, and yet you know, I really believe there's a way to do it. So I'm just glad you're here today to sort of bring to light your personal sort of experience with the system as it exists. And let me just say that, you know, for other small business people that are watching, you know, we're not trying to tax you to death. We're not trying to impose something on you that you can't live with. It's very much on my mind and the other sponsor's mind to find a solution you can live with that allows you to make a contribution towards your employees' health care, but then make a contribution towards your health care and still wind up with a system that gives them access to a doctor when they need to see one. So that's the idea, and I just appreciate you coming out and hearing today.
Senator Davis?
I'd like to make one other comment. It has to do with your testimony in the sense that I have introduced a bill that would take in consideration extending the age for young people to be covered under their parents' insurance up to the age of 24 or 26, depending on what we can get through. That would be beneficial to you as a 19-year-old coming out of the Connecticut care and not being able to get the insurance coverage for you. Maybe you might want to look at that bill. You might want to help promote it in the sense that it might be helpful to people like you and others that would need that coverage.
Great. Yep, Jesse.
Sure. I actually just moved up here in October from California. My mom lives in California. My dad is uninsured. Who knows where he is? So I'm not sure if that would really help me in particular then.
good emphasis.
Well, thank you both very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good luck. Let's go now to Joel Gilbertson. Joel may have, he's out in the audience, he may have winced when I said some of us fly to Seattle. Joel is Regional Director for Strategic Development and Administration at Providence Health Systems, Alaska. I personally am very, very, very appreciative of what Providence has done over the years with our family practice residency program. That was a great thing for our state. Providence is not only the largest healthcare organization in the state, but it's also Alaska's largest private employer with over 4,000 employees. And Joel, of course, former commissioner, has a great background in this area. So Joel, please go ahead. Welcome.
First of all, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you to the committee. In particular, echoing the comments from everyone today, I really want to commend the sponsors of this legislation for bringing it forward, starting the dialogue in the state. That, accompanied with the Governor's Strategies Council, I think has really started to put healthcare reform, change the discussion back on the radar screen. I was struck sitting in the back listening to the testimony today. I was thinking back about how complex we've made this system. And I was thinking about just even the story of Providence. When the Sisters of Providence came to Alaska in 1902, they came by boat to Nome. And a bunch of French-speaking sisters hopped off the boat. And during the gold rush days, worked with local folks who were panning for gold and set up a tithing system. Give us a little bit of gold you find and we'll run a hospital. So in 1902, our first hospital opened in Nome, and it didn't have paper. It didn't have all the technology we have today, of course, but there was a general spirit within Alaska that we as a community have to find ways that we can provide care. And as 105 years go by and other times pass, the complexity of healthcare certainly is in front of all of us today. So again, commending the sponsors for looking forward solutions, and it's important to further the debate at this point. Providence's commitment to improve healthcare in Alaska has not changed during that 105 years. We must continue to find ways, innovative ways, that we can deliver healthcare services. The chairman makes a comment about folks flying to Seattle. I think it's important to remember that 20 years ago, for many procedures, you did fly to Seattle. We have a wonderful group of cardiologists in this town, in Anchorage, that worked very hard the last 20 years to create a way in which they could develop a cardiac program so people could be served in the state. Same thing for neonates. Neonates flying out of state and now able to build a robust level 3 nursery in the state. And the benefit that's provided to consumers, being able to receive that care close to home, close to their family, and in a respectful way. The challenge we have is production. Everything at the end of the day is units of service. And when you buy a piece of equipment, to have 1,000 people use that piece of equipment or 10,000 people, you spread out the cost of that capital. And so it's always going to be a challenge in Alaska to find the right balance of what should we do in state, what should we do out of state. Burn centers, not going to do that in state for the foreseeable future. And we'll have to make these value decisions. But it gets difficult and challenging to make a bright line comparison between out-of-state care versus in-state care. At the end of the day, we as a society have to accept and decide what do we want in state, and to acknowledge that that may come with an increased cost. At Providence, the volume is staying strong. We've talked about emergency departments. We had over 70,000 emergency department visits last year at Providence, and a large portion of those individuals coming in are self-pay or uninsured, and that's growing. Our self-pay volume at Providence has been predictable for some period of time, and that's how we refer to people who don't have health insurance. But it's grown broadly. We've looked at just from 06 to 07, we're seeing trends rapidly increasing. I can't tell you what's happening in the marketplace. What we know is on an annual basis, and certainly something over the last 24 months has really expedited that, but a large number of individuals coming in unable to pay for their health care services, they still get the care. It's just not in the most efficient manner possible. At the end of the day, we only have three groups of people who receive health care services when you look at the payer side. We have the uninsured. We have those who have a government benefit, Medicare, Medicaid, and allocated care, whatever you might classify it as. And we have those who have commercial insurance. They may have gotten it from their employer or purchased it themselves or found it from a family member, but they're in three groups. Two of them are growing on an annual basis. The uninsured are growing, and the Medicare and Medicaid population is growing as a percent of the total piece of the pie. What's shrinking is commercial, and the cost of a healthcare system are constantly being pushed onto that one piece of the pie to keep the system afloat. What we know is it's not sustainable, and I really commend folks for looking at ways in which we can move that discussion forward. Just a couple general observations I'd like to share today. And I echo the comments from the commissioner, and I sort of consider myself a public health professional. That's my background. And I see the greatest public health threat in the state of Alaska right now is limited access and inappropriate access to healthcare services. And so as we talk about the discussion of reform, echoing the comments of the commissioner and, of course, knowing what the goal is of the stakeholders who are moving the legislation, focusing on access, not necessarily coverage, is key. We can cover folks, but if there's not a provider willing to accept that insurance, or there isn't a provider even available to provide that care, that coverage is not worth much. The second is, as we look at lessons learned from other states who are early on in the reform discussion, there's a couple things that stand out. One is, whether it's the reforms in the Northeast or in the Pacific Northwest, it's too early to really say how successful these will be and what the end results will be. So a common denominator is we're in our infancy. We're going to make some mistakes. There's going to be some challenges associated with doing something is at least changing the norm. Second, overwhelmingly, what we're seeing right now in state-specific reform initiatives are focused on access or coverage expansion, and not as much focus on controlling the actual cost of healthcare services themselves. And I think that needs to have an equal seat at the table. Third, many of them are inappropriately holding themselves hostage to federal action. And I think that there is ultimately going to need to be a federal solution that fits with the states. But a state like Alaska, where you look at our population size, and you say there's such a large percentage that are military dependents or have other federal beneficiaries, and you carve them out, you're talking about a population that's smaller than most counties. There's something really achievable here. Certainly I know the sponsors are not of the mindset that we are limited because of potential federal action we have to wait for. But I think there is a tone out there that this is a federal issue, and it's not. The other thing is to be mindful of is that each state was at a different starting point when it moved forward a reform bill. And each state has a separate set of circumstances in place at the time. And we have to be mindful of those as we go forward. For example, in some states, the state has been using Medicaid DSH funds to finance the health care services at hospitals for the uninsured and the underinsured. In Alaska, we don't do that. Those DSH funds go largely to underwrite the operations of the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. And I think it's being mindful of where the resources are and making sure we right-size our proposals for each state. And as we look at what the solution will be, I think we have to acknowledge that the solution is going to be multifaceted. We have to have an engaged citizenry, look at adequate and appropriately scaled access sites across the state, promoting sustainable primary care. Right now, the real fundamental problem, I just say there are two fundamental problems in our system that we fixed right away, access to primary care and long-term care services. We have to raise the bar on clinical quality. We're adamantly committed at Providence in raising the bar on clinical quality. We've committed to no unintentional deaths or injuries in our facilities, a very broad statement, a very difficult one to achieve, but it's one we're committed to and reporting on right now. Increasing individual responsibility, I think, has to be acknowledged with kind of what's the right level of personal responsibility, and address workforce issues. I think making sure we have the discussion moving in concert with these various initiatives is very important for being successful long term. The lasting and successful change in healthcare reform in Alaska will be ultimately dependent upon whether or not we can reach compromise. And I think groups need to be willing to compromise. This is not going to be a win-win game at the end of the day. Providers, beneficiaries, insurance companies, employers are all going to have to give and compromise. And ultimately, long-term cost improvement will come from decreased utilization. And I know that members are interested in prevention. I think focusing on ways in which we get more preventative services and stabilize primary care will make legislation like this ultimately successful. In closing, I commend the sponsors for, especially Senator French and others who really moved this forward, for starting the dialogue, putting this before our state, and we at Providence are, first of all, today excited to answer questions, but also committed to helping assist the committees and the legislature in our state as we try to address a more equitable and rational, defensible, and just healthcare system for Alaskans. Thank you.
Thank you, Joel. Excellent presentation. Questions or comments? Senator French?
Thank you. My question is about the 70,000 hospital visits you get in the emergency room through what you're calling self-pay.
Well, that's not all self-pay. That's the total emergency department visits.
Okay.
It's 70,000.
And what chunk of those, what percentage of those are what you and I would now call self-pay patients?
I knew when I said that I was going to invite that question. I don't have that with me. I apologize. What I will do is get that submitted in writing to the committee. I know that house-wide, looking at all of our inpatient services and at the medical campus, and it's very deceptive, the number, because of the way in which the charging system, the way you try to rationalize healthcare billing to really pull out good numbers. But house-wide, you look at about 7% is what we normally budget of our charges will be for self-pay individuals. And on the inpatient side, if you are self-pay, we collect 3 cents on the dollar. That's our average collection for a self-pay person who comes through the door. We budgeted this year for about 6.9% of charges. Again, it gets a little deceptive because you look at payer mix, even though they may be a smaller percent of our population, Medicare beneficiaries, for example, they actually are a much larger percentage in terms of actually needing services based on acuity. The disabled are very well insured, but they also receive much more services. This year, we're running already well over 9%, and each switch from 7% to 8%, 8% to 9%, each percentage change adds about another $9 million of uncompensated care into the system. So we have normally run at about $70 million, 65, 70 million. This year, we're running at a rate we'll probably be well over 90 million.
And I guess if I can follow up, how much of that uncompensated care do you get reimbursed for by, say, the federal government?
We get funding, obviously, for services. Providence does not receive any DSH funds, any federal disproportionate share hospital funds for Medicaid or Medicare. We have not received those funds from the state.
You say you get reimbursed for services?
On a claims basis from the DRGs.
And how much does that amount to, just in a roughly?
In terms of Medicare or Medicaid claim volume?
For the total amount of uncompensated care that you provide.
I'd have to get that number. I apologize. I just don't have that off the top of my head. We can get that for you.
Sure. We appreciate that. Senator Davis?
I was wondering if you could extend that a little bit. Would you be able to identify how many people that come through that uncompensated care may be people with insurance but have not utilized it because they cannot afford the copay and therefore just end up in the emergency room for their health care? Are you able to identify the percentage of people that come through that way?
We would not be able to identify individuals who had insurance but did not claim it or present it at the time they came in, no.
At some point, they do have to tell you where they have insurance or not insurance or...
Well, if you come through the emergency department, actually the last person you'll see if you go through the emergency department is when they ask you do you have insurance and how would you like to set up payment for the services. It's on exit in our emergency department. At that point, individuals who have insurance either presented or we work through some way to document it downstream, but there's no central database we're connecting with to see if that person ultimately has insurance or not.
All right, thank you.
And you said uncompensated care could be over $90 million?
We're looking at 7 months of the fiscal year closed out right now on an annual basis, so it's difficult to say. If the trend from the first half of the year continues, that's what we're looking at.
And do you make the distinction one of the presenters made about the difference between bad debt and uncompensated care as a subset?
Well, we break ours down by charity care, which are individuals who hit charity care thresholds, and we can provide them to the committee if you're interested in those, and then bad debt. And then those are, in total, are charges that were not recovered by the facility.
Okay, Joel, thank you very much. Appreciate your help.
Thank you.
We're open to any suggestion. Lend us your expertise. We'll need your help pushing this through. So
thank you very much.
We have three. Senator Cowdery has to go. Thank you for being here with us.
Thank you.
We have three final presenters to get through here. Don't want to shortchange anybody, but Mr. Patrick Higgins, if you could come forward. He's the Human Resources Director for North Star Behavioral Health System. North Star is the largest private mental health provider in Alaska. Mr. Patrick, welcome.
Thank
please
you.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Senator Ellis, and members of the committees. I am here representing North Shore as well as James Chill. James is the CEO and is unable to make it today because of prior commitments, but he felt it was very important for the comments to be here. Most of the comments that I have to make have already been made with a number of other people, and I'm not going to attempt to repeat that. Just a couple of points I would like to make. One is I do think the emphasis here is recognizing that there's three groups out there. There's the government-provided health care individuals, whether it's government employees, whether it's military, or whether it's Medicaid, Medicare is the biggest group. then you've got the insurance group, and then you have the self-pay, or in many cases, that's the group that doesn't pay, or not paying right now, but they are the ones not getting help. And that is, in large group, the people who are working but simply can't afford it. They're the ones delaying health care, sometimes with tragic consequences. They are the ones who are, when they do finally get health care, are costing more. And so there's a savings associated with that, I think, that needs to be emphasized. And that has a number of impacts, obviously, in society as well as us. The other point I'll mention is I can't help but wear the human resources hat, and I'm watching, listening to a Snow Cafe, and I'm listening to some of the other comments made here. Everybody's seen the reports of the growing number of uninsured, and there's been statements by companies talking about how they can't afford to work in this, they can't afford to be competitive in this country, but they have to go abroad to go to other places because of insurance, and that's driving it. I recall a few years ago, 2003, we had one group health insurance at the place I was working that basically was carried over from another group, and it cost about $10 per hour to provide this to a family coverage. Remember, when you hear the cost of insurance, you often hear it for individuals, you hear it for, you know, for married individuals, and then you hear families, and the families are more. And the predictions that way within the Society of Human Resources Management, it's about 200,000 member organization of HR professionals, started focus on that, about a 14% growth rate, cost additional in health care. And 14% is 5 years has doubled. And we expect to continue this for 10 years. You're talking $10 becoming 20 and 5, and 20 becoming 40 and 10. The cost of group health insurance can't be focused on what we're doing today strictly in terms of the uninsured. I mean, that is a major component. But the impact on insurance for employers and being competitive, it goes beyond a small employer. It gets to the big employers. It gets to everyone. We simply have more and more people dropping out of covering health insurance. And when that insurance pool continues to shrink, it's going to cost everyone else more. I hope that when they do an estimate of the cost of implementing this program, they take into account the cost of that insurance to state and local, some of the balances out there, so that when the cost of this program and what it's going to take and what the consequences will be if they don't do something today. And I'll just close by saying, since Hollis Finch, I appreciate what you're doing on this and what others who are joining in on this. I think it is vital work for us here in Alaska and in the country that something be done about this as quickly as possible. I appreciate that.
Mr. Egan, thanks for being here and your presentation. You. Any comments or questions? If not, thank you very much again. And I stand corrected. We have four more brief presenters as we close out today's hearing. And the next is Karen Rhodes, owner-operator of Northern Living Centers. Karen Rhodes operates and manages a five-bed assisted living home in Wasilla. Karen will be followed by Wayne Stevens, Vince Beltrami, Pat Center. And then I'm going to ask briefly if our two national experts can function as respondents. If anything's been said today that you would like to get on the record, please, we'll give you the opportunity to do so as we wrap up. Welcome. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Ellis. Chair Davis, Senator French, thank you very much for this opportunity to testify. I have so much to say on this. It was really hard to pare down my thoughts and comments, but some of the discussion today kind of helped me narrow down what I wanted to focus on. First of all, I wanted to state that I do currently have a five-bed assisted living facility. I'm adding on seven beds right now. I have five employees, and I'll be adding two more on when my addition is complete, hopefully in November. I am a stakeholder in this situation on several levels, as a healthcare provider, as an employer, and as a working Alaskan without insurance. Alaskans consider mandates to be inherently evil. And I want to just encourage you not to be afraid of the mandates. As a small employer and as an Alaskan who needs insurance and can't afford it, I believe that if the mandates are reasonable, people will not object to them. I also serve on the Governor's Healthcare Strategies Council. One of the studies that we found did a survey of people across the nation, and they found that people are willing to pay into a health care plan if the cost is reasonable. The average figure they found was about $100 a month people are willing to pay for health care, especially government-sponsored health care programs. People are not afraid to pay into this. as long as it's reasonable. Even as an employer, I find the mandates in SB 160 to be very fair and very reasonable. I would be more than happy to pay into this program. I would say that it would be important for the mandates to have a cap. There is only so much blood you can get out of a turnip. And, you know, if we don't put caps on these things, we'll be back to where we are now in that we can't afford the program. But to start out discussing mandates and requiring minimal mandates, I have no fear of that at all. I believe that the ownership requirements of this program counteract any fear of Big Brother. Again, I've seen studies as far as healthcare council goes that say that ownership actually encourages participation, giving people the opportunity to make that choice. My situation is kind of unique in that as an assisted living home in Wasilla,